pleasure to be here. These are my collaborators of the last 2 years or so. There are many other important people that I should have listed here. Of course, one of them is Xincha Cheng here, but these are the newer ones, so let me start here. So you hear often things about the standard model that we know it's SUSY or it's something else, and I just thought I should put together what we know about the standard model when it comes to symmetries. So we know that there is a gauge symmetry, and we know that there is a Lorentz symmetry, SL3, comma 1. There is a baryon number conservation at some level, given that the proton doesn't decay. And all the other symmetry I can think about that the standard model has is CPT. Now, if you look at the fermions, the quantum numbers look like a complete zoo, and not only there are weird numbers here, but they come in three copies. Well, SUSY gods do something really nice. They put this into a single gauge group, and when you do that, all this zoo comes down to basically one representation, the 16 of SL10, but still you have three copies which you don't understand. At least the gauge couplings unify at a high energy scale, which seems to be in good agreement with the fact that you have supersymmetry in that picture. However, you don't see much about the rest of the things. Let's see. So what I'm going to talk about today is a completely different story. Something I'm not going to say anything about unifying the gauge group, although this can be done at some higher energy scales. I will talk about extending the space-time symmetry, Lorentz symmetry, instead of SL3, comma 1 to SL5, comma 1, that requires two extra dimensions. And in this process, I'm going to explain something about the baryon number here. It's going to be a consequence of that. And what I like even more is that this number 3 is explained by the mathematical consistency of the theory. I'm not sure if this is better or worse, probably it's worse than supersymmetry, but at least it's a completely different story about how physics works at the TV scale and above. So for people interested in LHC physics, that's an opportunity for thinking of different signals.
So will your model be supersymmetric then?
No.
And will the gauge couplings unify?
No. Unless you go at higher energy scales. In extra dimensions at higher energies, you can put everything in E8 plus E8 of string theory with supersymmetry. But in terms of finding super partners, no, you will not find super partners. You'll find some other things at the LHC. Okay, so the context I'm talking about is this universal extra dimensions that Xincha and collaborators proposed some time ago. This is the simple statement that all standard model particles propagate in the bulk, and then the Kaltz-Klein modes are just some new particles which have in four dimensions, which are actually states of definite momentum along the extra dimensions. Since everybody's everywhere, there is some remnant of momentum conservation along the extra dimensions. And this is leading to Kaltz-Klein number conservation. So the Kaltz-Klein number is something that tells you what is the momentum in the extra dimension of this particle. It turns out that loops break even this down, but you are left always with a Kaltz-Klein parity. So this parity is important for collider phenomenology. Now the bounds, you know, if you look at loop corrections to the Dublin Z masses, you find a shift, and there is a longer story here, but overall, the limits on the compactification scale come from loops or from pair production at the Tevatron, and they tell you that this extra dimension can be right around the corner. What is this good for? It's for several things, but one thing that is very popular for my cosmology friends in the back there is that you have a viable dark matter candidate, which is quite popular on AstroPH. Of course, Xincha knows everything about that. Here, this tells you that for 1 over r of a half to 1 TeV or so, you get the right radic abundance. And then there are nice stories about direct detection and indirect detection of this dark matter candidate, which
has interactions.
Right. So this is the Kurzweil mode of the photon. It interacts, for instance, with an electron Kurzweil mode and a photon. And an electron. So you have, for instance, a positron signals by annihilation of the dark matter candidate in the sun, things like that. So that's the kind of interaction. It's very similar to the interactions you have in supersymmetry, where the neutrino interacts with the selectron and an electron, which is hidden enough to be dark matter, and yet not completely hidden, so you can have a chance of seeing it in CDMS and other experiments.
He wants to know if you can see it at the LHC.
That's my main topic, but I was so happy to see that.
Well, I wanted to know if you could see it in these direct detection experiments, too.
Right, CDMS, you know.
Yeah,
you see, our LHC friends care a lot about dark matter experiments, and vice versa.
They do it first, that's fine.
Right.
So do you have the same huge variation in possible detection?
Actually, this is better than for the five-dimensional case, at least the dark matter candidate that has spin one, it's a better has better chances of being seen at CDMS because the cross sections are bigger. There is some story there I can tell you more about.
How strongly is this coupled to the visible brain?
There is no such thing as a visible brain. So
this is all bulk stuff.
Yes, we all live in an extra dimension. We all have an extra dimension with certain thickness there. So this is what we would call the no-brain scenario, right? The no-brainer.
What I'm curious about is, in order for these things to basically be the dark matter, not only do you need to have the eye couplings and masses, you need to make them in some ways. So how do you think you can make them?
Yeah, so this is well established. They are produced thermally in the early universe, and then you have some annihilation cross-section, and this is what comes into this computation. This black line comes from the annihilation cross-section, which is large enough to give the right radical density for compactification scale here. But then you can be more precise, and you can include interactions with the other Kurzweil particles, and this co-annihilation will reduce the compactification scale. No, they couple to the standard model with couplings which are dimensionless, given by the standard model gauge couplings, except that you always preserve Kurzweil numbers. So you come with a photon in extra with Kurzweil number 1, and you go to an electron and an electron with Kurzweil number 1. This coupling here is the electromagnetic gauge coupling, more or less. Okay?
Yeah, yeah.
So this is a dimensional thing, but the only reason you don't see them so easily is because you preserve this KK number. So the only way you can see them is either to pair produce them at the Tevatron, or else in loops, electroid precision measurements, things like that. Is that okay?
Yeah, I think that's what I'm.
In a sense, if you integrate out this thing, then you can say it's coupling with TV scale, supposed.
Yes. That's right.
Right.
It's this issue of normalization.
Right.
I think that I understand.
Any other questions so far? That was supposed to be a very brief introduction to the case of 5D, and I'm not going to touch 5D at all, since this is such a famous subject on HPH nowadays. I'm going to concentrate only on the case of two extra dimensions, which you might think, well, he finished working on 1D, now he's looking at two extra dimensions. Next year he will come with three extra dimensions and so on, be able to retire with many dimensions. The story is somewhat different, though. And that's because 6D is very special. First, I'll argue it's more interesting than one extra dimension. And then I'll argue that more than six dimensions is not something that I can deal with. I leave that to string theorists that live in different mathematical dimensions. The reason it's special comes actually from several places. First, fermions in 4+n dimensions have chiral fermions, any chiral representations of the Lorentz group, only when the number of dimensions is even. Now, chiral fermions are interesting. They set lots of constraints on what kind of couplings you can write between them, as well as what kind of fermions are allowed to be written in a self-consistent theory. And that's what happens in four dimensions with the standard model, where anomaly cancellation tells you that you cannot have just quarks, you also need leptons. Something similar will happen here in six dimensions. Still, this just tells you that 6 or 8 or 10 would be interesting, not necessarily 6. But then chirality is very different than every other four dimensions. This is a funny property of the Lorentz group. And 6 dimensions looks like 10, but 8 is very different and looks like 4. And I'll show you in a second that even between 6 and 10 dimensions, there are very important differences which make 6 unique in some sense. So if I want to study a field theory in 6 dimensions, then I cannot really extend my study to other number of dimensions. The one thing to know about 6 dimensions is that you have a chirality, the way you define gamma 5 in 4 dimensions, and allows you to have axial couplings of the Z and W. The same way you have a chirality here, which we label by plus and minus instead of left and right. And a chiral fermion in 6 dimensions has actually 4 degrees of freedom, which in terms of the 4-dimensional language means a left-handed fermion and a right-handed fermion with spins up and down. These are the 4 components. Okay, so when you see plus and minus, you should remember I refer to a 6-dimensional fermion. Now, maybe I should go pretty fast through the beginning since I want to get to the LHC section before John disappears from here. Also, this is somewhat older stuff that you might have seen on the web before. One thing is that once you are in 6 dimensions, you have lots of constraints from anomalies. One of them is that if you have fermions on a loop here and gravitons here, in order to not to spoil general relativity or invariance under general coordinate transformations, then you need the sum over all these diagrams to be 0. And gravity knows only about the number of fermions, which tells you that the fermions with plus chirality should have the same number as the ones with minus chirality. And then this has implications for neutrino. It tells you, just by looking at the standard model, you find that within each generation there are 15 fermions, if you count color degrees of freedom. So that tells you you need an extra one to make it even. But this is the simplest thing. And therefore, you can write the chiralities in two different ways here. So if you choose chirality plus for the quark doublet under SU2 within one generation, then the quark singlets have to have opposite chirality to cancel the QCD anomaly. And then here, if the lepton doublet has plus, then the lepton singlet, in other words, the right-handed electron of the standard model, will have minus chirality, and the right-handed neutrino, same chirality. There is another option there. And just to finish the story about motivation, it turns out that there is this global gauge anomaly, which in the standard model tells you that the number of doublets has to be even. That's something that Witten discovered in 1983. It turns out that in the standard model, the number of doublets is even anyways. If you look in one generation, you have a quark doublet, which is 3 degrees, 3 fermions in a sense, and then one lepton doublet, which is a 4th one, and therefore you have an even number of doublets. That's why you don't hear about that very often when people talk about the standard model. In 2 more dimensions, the story is more complicated. You have to look at this homotopy group of SU2 in 6 dimensions, which is a larger discrete group, Z12. And then our string theory people tell us that this translates into a requirement of having 6 doublets, so or a multiple of 6 doublets. So only a theory with a multiple of 6 doublets is mathematically consistent in six dimensions. So now if you count in the standard model, quark doublet gives you 3 degrees, 3 doublets, and lepton doublet is an extra doublet, and this is not a multiple of 6, therefore one generation is not good. It turns out that only a multiple of 3 generations satisfies this requirement, which might be an explanation for why we have 3 generations so far observed in experiments. There are, of course, many things one should talk about here, but let me zoom towards phenomenology. Okay. So far I said very general things about 6 dimensions. Now, in order to get to physics as we know it, we have to compactify to all this. So if you compactify on something that looks like a torus, so where you would identify opposite sides on this square, this and that, for instance, then on a torus you always find that a four-dimensional chiral fermion decomposes to a vector like four-dimensional fermions. In other words, for each fermion that you start with chirality, let's say plus, you'll find a left-handed and a right-handed fermion at low energy in four dimensions, which have the same quantum numbers, and that's not how the standard model looks like. We don't see a right-handed electron which is SU2 doublet. So we cannot do that. We can do the next simplest thing, though. Identify the adjacent sides here. So if I identify this side with this side and this with that, note that this looks more like a sphere than a torus. Then I can show, and I'll show you maybe a bit later, that you get chiral fermions out of this. Now, what does identification mean? It means that if you are walking this way, then you come out this way, and the physics should be the same here as there. In other words, I want the Lagrangian at each point along this line to be the same as the Lagrangian at the corresponding point on that line. And not only the Lagrangians to be, well, so I want the Lagrangian that ensures that the physics is the same at the two points. If you think of how, for instance, the kinetic term for a scalar field looks like, the Lagrangian would still be the same if I allow a phase to change. So the field here might have a phase different than the field there. But you can work out the field equations in on this space and find that this phase has to be a multiple of pi over 2. Okay, so you have a choice of boundary conditions, but not too many choices. The choices are labeled by an integer n that can go from 0, 1, 2, or 3. And furthermore, to have the physics the same is not enough to have this relation. You also need the derivatives to be identified. In other words, the derivative along this direction should be the same as along that. And these two conditions ensure that the boundary conditions are really satisfied. We call this the chiral square compactification.
So you need some particular tension at the corners, right?
Right. So the corners are have conical singularities. So the way you can see that is like a sphere with three special points. This point is identified with that, but then these have some conical singularities. Any compactification of higher dimensions that gives you chiral fermions has something like that, right? Okay, so now you just have to go ahead and solve the Klein-Gordon equation on this space with this boundary. It's everything like in Jackson electromagnetism, except these are different kind of fields. And you find that the solutions are functions of x4 and x5, the coordinates along the two extra dimensions, with some integers j and k. This is the problem of a particle in a box. I have a two-dimensional box. I solve standing wave solution, the wave equation, and then find the standing wave solutions. So this 0, 2, 1, and 3 are these four types of boundary conditions that I can have, as I said in the beginning. For instance, if you are going to talk about the standard model Higgs, then that has to have a wave function of the type F0, because if you inspect this a little bit, you'll find that the only flat wave function that is everywhere in the bulk is of the type F0. And we want the standard model Higgs to be a zero model in this theory.
And R is the radius of the,
exactly,
the torus, the major, minor.
So L is pi R. Okay? But 1 over R is the mass of the first Kaltzak-Kleinmann one. So here, in units of 1 over R, I show you the spectrum. So the first particles, the ones that are the lightest and the ones to be discovered at the Tevatron soon, I hope, have quantum numbers 1, 0, and they have mass 1 over R. The next one has quantum numbers 1 and 1. And therefore, the mass is square root of 2 times 1 over R. Then 2, 0, this is twice 1 over R, and so on. Okay? What I want you to concentrate for this talk are these two things. So the lightest Kaltzak-Klein particle, and the next one, which has mass square root of 2 times that. in case you like to see nice plots, these are the wave functions for particles that have zero modes. This is the first Kaltz-Klein function, and this is the next one, maybe one more. Okay, then you do gauge fields, right? And so far I talked about scalars. Gauge fields are pretty much the same, except you have to make sure you have a gauge invariance in the theory. Fields that are A mu, for instance, the photon with mu going from 0 to 1 to 3, have a decomposition in terms of this KK function F0 of JK. And these are going to be some heavy photons from a four-dimensional point of view that you have to discover in your detector. Then the gauge boson in extra dimension has polarizations not just 0 to 3, but also 4 and 5, because there are two more dimensions. And therefore, a gauge boson with polarization along the extra dimension gives you some more degrees of freedom, which also have a tower of particles in four dimensions. It turns out that this A plus, which is the Kaltz-Klein mode of an A plus A4 plus IA5, and A minus, which comes from this combination, mix together, and one degree of freedom becomes the longitudinal component of the vector boson. Whereas the other, so that's what I call AG. The other combination remains as a physical state of spin zero that has to be discovered at colliders. And it turns out that which linear combination is which depends on at which Kaltz-Klein level you are. There is a phase here that changes with the Kaltz-Klein state, which is important for deriving the Feynman rules. So just to make it a bit more transparent, here is your photon, mass zero. Here is the heavy photon of mass 1 over r, which besides the two transverse components here has an additional degree of freedom of longitudinal polarization. On top of that, you have a spinless particle AH, which we call the spinless object. And then things repeat themselves at square root of 2 over r, 2 over r, and so on. Are there any questions?
You're going to tell us how these things behave?
I'm going towards that at full speed, and I might lose everybody in the process of doing so. So let me know whenever you have questions. Good, so I told you about spin 0, spin 1. Let me tell you what the fermions do in this space. So a fermion of chirality plus in six dimensions decomposes to something which has a chirality left in four dimensions and chirality right. And if the one with chirality left has a zero mode, then this is a Fourier decomposition in terms of the F0 functions. And these are going to be some heavy fermions. Whereas this doesn't have a zero mode, it's just decomposed in terms of heavy Kaltz-Klein particles. And this and that form together a heavy fermion, whereas this one remains as a massless fermion, which is, once you break electroweak symmetry, symmetry is the standard model fermion. Now, if you try to solve the Dirac equation, you find that there are some relations between the wave functions in the extra dimension for the right-handed fermion and the left-handed one, and they all work together so that you get these decompositions. And again, to make things a bit more transparent for those of you that haven't seen these things before, you have the massless fermions that get at some point mass from electroweak symmetry breaking coupling to the Higgs. So let's say this is the top and bottom left-handed doublet, and this is the right-handed top. These are the zero modes, which have a wave function which is flat in along the extra dimensions. And then you have particles with momentum in the extra dimensions, which from a four-dimensional point of view are a heavy doublet under SU2 and a heavy singlet under SU2, and both have left and right-handed components. So here, perhaps somebody should come with some smart names for what are the Kaltz-Klein excitation of the top and bottom. So far, I just used some not-so-inspiring notation. And then the whole thing repeats itself. Are there questions about this? So in case it's not clear for our experimental colleague, we use a somewhat different language in these theory seminars here. What we are saying is that this is not a fourth generation, a top prime along the lines of a fourth generation, but rather it's a vector-like quark, which means it has a mass that doesn't break electroweak symmetry. It can get a mass without it coupling to a Higgs. So in a sense, this is a top prime, but the top prime which couples to left hand, that couples to the same way, whether it's left-handed or right-handed, it couples the same way to the W. Okay? And this is another top prime. So you have a tower of top primes here and bottom primes. It's pretty interesting. You have lots of interesting signals to look at. And this comes from very few assumptions, just putting the standard model in some two extra dimensions, nothing fancier than that. Let me skip over some stuff here, which I should get back if in case you'd like to have more motivation for this theory. One thing is that these boundary conditions and the Lagrangian in general here, the whole action is actually invariant under rotation with respect to the center of this square. In other words, you have the 6D Lagrangian invariant under x4 goes to L minus x4 and x5 goes to L minus x5. And if you work out in terms of Kautz-Klein modes, you find that there is a Z2 invariance that takes any Kautz-Klein number, Kautz-Klein particle of number j and k into minus 1 to the j plus k times itself. And this tells you that you can group all the Kautz-Klein numbers into two classes, the even states, which have j plus k even. This includes us, everything that we are made of, and Kautz-Klein particles such as 1, 1, because 1 plus 1 is 2. And then you have the odd particles, which have j plus k odd. And this is, for instance, the dark matter candidate will be an odd particle which cannot decay to even particle if indeed this Z2 symmetry is preserved. Okay. So that's about everything I wanted to say about the underlying theory. Now you can go ahead and compute cross sections, basically. I mean, you want to do everything from this stage and find the phenomenology and see whether nature behaves like that or not. So one thing is to look at the spectrum of these Kautz-Klein particles. So let me start with the lightest particles, which have Kautz-Klein number 1 and 0. So these are odd states according to this KK parity, which means that you can only pair produce them at the Tevatron or other colliders. Now, to a first approximation, everybody has mass 1 over R. However, once you break electroweak symmetry, the top W and Z get some boost, a little bit more than 1 over R, if 1 over R is larger than the electroweak scale. But what's more important, which has been for the first time observed by our friend Qin Qia and his collaborators, is that loop corrections split further the spectrum. And that's because Lorentz invariance, which initially kept everybody at the same mass, is broken by the compactification. Now, computing this thing is highly non-trivial. It's been done by our friends here for the case of one extra dimension as well as a certain two-dimensional compactification. For our purpose, the results are given in this heroic paper by Ponton and Wang. I really invite you to read that paper. It's pretty interesting. What they find is this spectrum. So let's analyze for a second the spectrum. The largest correction comes to particles that have color. So this is the gluon Kautz-Klein mode and has the largest correction, therefore it's the highest here. And these are the quarks, which also have pretty large one-loop corrections to their masses. What's below here doesn't have color. So these are the lepton Kautz-Klein modes. And you see 1 over R is 500. So these have splittings which are not too big above 500, and as well as some splittings below 500. what's on this column has spin 1. Here, these particles have spin 0, and this has spin 1/2. Okay? The most interesting of all are these things of spin 0. First of all, these don't exist in 5D, so whatever the literature says about Kurzweil-Klein phenomenology for universe extra dimension, in one extra dimension, doesn't apply to these things. So I'll spend some time explaining what they do here. Another thing to notice is that at some point, the fermions are heavier, and these lowest states talk to each other, but they cannot have a decay to a lepton, to lepton pairs, for instance. They will have to have some decay among themselves, which will make the phenomenology quite interesting. Okay, so maybe before I get into production at Hadron Colliders, maybe I should hear some questions. I'm sure I said things way too fast.
Why would you expect this 1 over R is like the key viscosity that you can observe as particles at Hadron Colliders in SUSY or in actually mission on that aim at solving the hierarchy problem? You can see that after particles must exist at heat, but in this model, I don't see the reason.
So there are two reasons. One of them is just phenomenological. I don't know how heavy these things are, but the current limits on them are maybe coming from round one of the Tevatron. So, they can be at 300 GeV, and it's worth thinking what happens if they are really not too far above that. The other reason is that you want somehow the hierarchy to be explained here as well. If you were to put this at 10 to the 10 GeV, you would have a huge hierarchy between the electroweak scale and 10 to the 10 GeV, and you'll have lots of fine tuning. So the story is that in the energy scale here, you have the electroweak scale where we are right now, and then at some point you open 1 over R, not much above that, and then this is a higher dimensional gauge theory which becomes strongly coupled at scale lambda, which lambda is, something like 10 times 1 over R. And beyond that, it's some unknown physics there. But that unknown physics should be somehow able to explain the hierarchy between this scale of a few TeV and the Planck scale, which is much higher. And there are simple ways of doing that. Let me not use the word string theory. So let's say on top of the two extra dimensions which are universal, you have another extra dimension which is warped. So then you arrange a Randall-Sundrum model, which instead of being a 4 plus 1 dimensional model is in Randall-Sundrum, this is a 6 plus 1 dimensional, which would be quite cool actually, because one problem with the Randall-Sundrum is that naively you would have proton decay very fast mediated by TeV scale physics, whereas here there is something I skipped over, namely that you have a Z8 discrete symmetry, a leftover from rotational invariance in the space of the two extra dimensions, and that prevents the QQQL operators that lead to proton decay. So, even if you take these extra dimensions, which are universal, only as an explanation for why in Randall's syndrome you don't have proton decay, I think that would be good enough motivation to do everything at the TeV scale.
Would a spectrum of these at 1 over R equals 500 not have any effect on the electroweak precision observer?
They do, but their effect is not very large because all the electroweak observables involve only zero modes particles that we have observed. And there is this Kurzweil-Klein number conservation law that says you cannot have a 1-0 and a 0. You cannot couple a single 1-0 mode between two zeros. In other words, you cannot change G Fermi by exchanging a heavy W between quarks or leptons. What you have to do is to couple two of them, and then in order to have an impact on electroweak observables, the only way you can do it is by completing a loop. So that's a loop-suppressed thing. And the limit of 3 to 500 GeV on 1 over R comes from computing these things.
Okay.
So coming back to your question, it's true that so you solve somehow the big hierarchy problem, but you still have a little hierarchy problem, and so that you still have a quadratic divergence pushing the x-mass to lambda.
Right.
So
yeah, so you don't want lambda to be too high, and if you really worry about this hierarchy, there is a nice paper by Gustavo Burman and another person, Gomez, I think, where they do a little Higgs-like explanation for this separation here. You need some additional physics if you really were. I don't worry too much about this little hierarchy, but perhaps one should worry. So, yes. So let's say you have a quark here, which is quark 1, 0, and then you can exchange here a gluon, let's say gluon JK, and then here you would have a quark, something like J plus 1 and K. You want to have couplings like that, and quark 1, 0. So if you look at this kind of correction to the mass of the quark, then this goes like G strong, SU3 coupling. Right, exactly. Whereas if you do the same thing for leptons, then you'll have the G of SU2 here, which is smaller. I mean, it's a simple argument about the relative sizes of the couplings.
The supersymmetry model, of course, you need a big quark lever arm in order to generate a gluon mass that's so high. Here you have a shorter lever arm, but you say just when you put in the numbers, this is what you get.
Your colleague has computed that. You should grill him on. Okay. Good. So now let's do the heavy lifting. You know, the story up to the point I had here was pretty much in place last year. When Eduardo Pontón, Gustavo Guzmán, and I wrote that paper about this model. The next stage was how do we compute pair production of the 1-0 modes, the lightest Kaltz-Aklein particles. And probably just staring at these slides, you'll understand why I was reluctant to get into this. It's a tough computation at the LHC. So here I refer to the main production mechanism at the LHC. I have similar slides for the Tevatron. You can start with two quarks in the initial state, and then you exchange a gluon, a heavy gluon in the T channel, and have two heavy quarks produced here. But you can also exchange this spinless adjoint, which is a color octet of spin zero. Okay. But then you can have gluons in the initial state, and then you have several diagrams, or you can have quarks, one quark and one gluon, and then you have these things that where you produce a heavy quark and a heavy spinless particle. But then you can replace each of these spinless particle lines with one heavy gluon line, and you have lots of production mechanisms. Also, you can pair produce these things. There are even funny vertices with two gluons and two heavy GH. This is a small subset. So I was terrified by the thought of computing that. That was until Casey Kong taught me how to use CalHep, which is a pretty nice tool. CalHep is a program that does things like that automatically, provided you teach it the vertices. So we have now included all this model in CalHep. There are lots of particles, lots of interactions, but you do it once, and then you compute whatever you like within a few clicks of a button. And that's the result here for the production cross-section at the LHC. If you like to see Tevatron slides, I'll show you some later. So let's see, what do we find? For a 500 GeV 1 over R, we find, for instance, that you produce one gluon and one quark, heavy gluon and heavy quark, with a cross section of about 20 picobars. That's huge for the LHC. You are going to have, let's say, within the first year, one inverse femtobarn, you are going to have 20,000 heavy Kaltz-Aklein particles produced. Okay, so given that you have so many of them, you can get creative about what decay modes they have and look for really interesting signals in the first year at the LHC. So let's start with some simple ones. Actually, the more interesting ones, I even don't have them on the slides, given that they are in continuous flow for now. So the simplest one would be the equivalent of five dimension, which is the one studied by Cynthia and his friends. You start with the, if you are at the LHC two gluons here, for instance, that's one of the production mechanisms. And then they start decaying, and they have this cascade decay where they preserve the Kaluza-Klein numbers. 1,0 remains 1,0 because it has nothing to decay into otherwise. So you throw here a quark, and then you decay to a W mu, which can be the neutral one. So this is, in a sense, the Kaluza-Klein mode of the Z. And then you have a lepton. And finally, what's really special about 6B in this diagram is that the lightest Kaluza-Klein particle has spin 0 as opposed to spin 1. And this is your dark matter candidate. And then you do the same here, but through the charged one, and you have a nice three lepton plus just plus missing energy. These are missing energy in the CDF detector. Now, I show you that just to make a connection to 5D. It turns out that in 6D, the branching fractions here are not the largest ones. You have some other decay modes that are preferred. But still, this is not negligible. So the signal here is two hard leptons. This comes only from knowing what's the mass difference between that. One somewhat softer lepton and some jets that maybe you don't care about and some missing ET. Now, given that we have a member of CDF in the audience, I should raise the question, why CDF is not looking for this in RAN 2, given that you have a really nice limit from RAN 1? That's a rhetorical question.
Who said we're
not? Huh?
Who said we're not?
Well, not yet. I mean, that's...
We're doing things in a less model-specific way. I mean, we're looking for, final states that look like this.
No, I know. One should
Could
be able...
Could one of these branches, for example, have all jets in it, canvassing energy?
Yeah, because you start with color particles, so you have to get rid of color. So,
in other words, you could have one hard lepton and the rest jets and missing ET?
No, so the signal is pretty much three leptons plus missing ET, and the jets, as I said, to a first approximation, you can ignore.
I'm just asking if the W mu 1,0 could decay to jets.
No.
Instead of leptons.
No.
Ever.
The reason is because they always have to preserve 1,0, so these things are heavier than that.
Yeah.
And therefore, they cannot decay to that. They decay only to leptons. Okay? Yes, but they are tremendously suppressed compared to those.
Yeah. They can't go to BW, for example.
BH and the W, that happens at one loop level and is also extremely suppressed. It's also not kinematically allowed. I'll show you a few other decay modes and stuff.
The only reason I ask is that we've done this P-prime search, as we call it, but it's just really a search for lepton plus jet plus missing energy, and we have two absolutely off-scale bizarre events.
I see.
In that sample, which I'll be happy to show you.
Mm-hmm.
We showed it at the line sheet before.
Okay, we should talk about it. In any case, I'll show you more types of what you can have here. But you have jets if you really, but they are not high PT. Okay.
Guarantee there's no second lepton. There's really just one lepton.
I can't even guarantee that.
Oh.
Yes, so the way they did the search in RAN 1 is by looking at the trilepton SUSY sample, and they set limit on that, dedicated limit on this model, which is the best limit worldwide right now, but with about a tenth of the data existing. So that's why I'm anxious to see somebody doing it in RAN 2.
But this wouldn't help you to... distinguish your model from supersymmetry.
Right, so here again, Cynthia is the expert that tells you that this looks like SUSY to a first approximation, and then there is a huge growing literature on how to distinguish this from SUSY. It turns out that this is the only SUSY looking like thing in 6D. In 6D, you have many more weird stuff that would allow you immediately to tell that's not SUSY, unless it's a very weird kind of SUSY where you throw more things in. Okay, so here's something with larger branching fractions that still gives you pretty much three leptons plus missing ET plus jets. So given that the coupling here is proportional to G strong, is G strong basically, the quarks actually, instead of going to the Ws of the 1,0 kind, go to the spinless adjoints of the 1,0 type. Now, this don't have any fermion 1,0 heavier than them, so the only thing that they can do is to decay three bodies. So here you integrate out some heavy 1-0 fermion, and then you throw two quarks, a QQ bar, and then you can go to B mu 1-0. So that's the hypercharged GH boson. And then this one can decay three body also to two leptons, let's say E plus E minus, and missing ET. Here you can have something similar, maybe, and then for instance, you also have a coupling also a three body decay of GH to the spinless subjoint. I guess this is spinless, whereas this is spin one, and three leptons plus missing energy. However, this.
Those leptons would be soft dish in general, or you have a wide spectrum or not.
So let's see, B mu and BH. We go back here. B mu has a mass of about 500 GeV, BH is about 80 GeV, less than that. So yes, each lepton has 30, 40 GeV, which I would call soft compared to SUSY, but our LHC people would say that's more than enough to see.
192 GeV.
What's 192?
In his event, he's trying to explain with your model.
You should not hurry, because I have lots of decay modes. So I should probably I'm not going to show you all of them, but tell me the event and I'll try to explain it. Okay.
Well, we have one from run one, too, that had three leptons in, including 180 jet electrons and two jets.
So I bet there is no problem to find it here. The only question is, once you find that, you have to, with a certain cross-section, you can predict cross-sections for basically all the other things. So if you have that and you don't have another event that would be predicted, then I'll be in trouble. So one has to be careful in making statements here. But
the message I'm getting is we should be looking for multiple leptons.
Ah, so here is a plot that I was planning to write, a Feynman diagram that I was planning to show you, but I didn't have time to draw this morning. So let me just draw it here, because it's getting really interesting. And the interesting thing is, in 6D, you have this many states, so you can have really long cascade decays. So let's say you start with one of these quark 1-0. You throw a quark here. Then you can have a W mu 1-0. This can decay, it can decay to a lepton, another lepton, and another lepton here. So this is lepton 1-0. Then you can go to a B mu now. Then B mu can decay to what would be a heavy lepton if it were light enough, and LL. And then here you would have a WH, a spinless. So if you look at the masses we have in the spectrum, this is heavier than that, which is heavier than that, this is lighter than that, so this is effectively a three-body decay. Mm-hmm. And then this is lighter than that. And yet this can also decay to a three-body, to a lepton, and BH, which is stable. Okay? So now, let's see, did I overdo it? Probably. So it turns out that the decay, the branching fractions here are a bit too small. However, if you look at some other ones, which also go like that, getting four leptons on one branch is not a big deal. It's something of a few percent branching fraction combined. So then, in principle, you can get four leptons on one side and four leptons on the other, which would be a really amazing eight lepton decay. However, this...
I don't think we see any of
those. Right. So, however,
so what's the cross-section there?
Yeah, if you go to... We have a plot of how many leptons versus cross-section. It turns out that four or more is pretty large, and I think that's the best discovery mode at the LHC. But five leptons is not too small. Again, you have perhaps 100 events in the first 10 inverse femtobarons. Eight is probably out of question, but four, five, six leptons is not a big deal.
Those are LHC numbers?
Yes, LHC numbers.
Any
the Tevatron has much less reach, and that has to be... We have to analyze exactly what's the current limit from the Tevatron. Probably it's around 300 and something GeV, based on our plots.
So no better than the precision constraints, that's what you're saying.
Well, you see, the precision constraints are highly dependent on what is the standard model Higgs mass, And also, they are highly dependent on new higher dimensional operators at the cutoff scale. So I don't take the precision constraints very seriously. Our direct searches from CDF and D0 are much more reliable, except we want to see them analyzed from this point of view.
So the big L10 there, do those carry E, mu, and tau flavors?
Right, so when I say L here, so this can be E plus, E minus, this can be mu plus, mu minus, and so on.
But if the big L is, say, a tau 10.
Yeah, you lose something in the branching
then
fraction.
It decays to a tau. Light tau.
Right. So I know you like taus, but first you are going to see the electrons and muons, and then the taus.
But do you think there's an inverted mass hierarchy?
No, the couplings are universal.
So that means that the heavy.
So if you have
excitations are heavier than the. Yeah, two. In other words, since the tau is heavier than the.
No, it doesn't make any difference. That's what I'm saying. The cross sections are the same for electrons as well as for taus.
I'm just trying to ask whether the big L. Version could be the lightest
version. No, actually, they are almost degenerate, but it's slightly heavier because the tau is right. It goes higher. Okay. Let me know when I'm going out of time because I have lots of things to continue showing you. But okay. I haven't finished the story of the 1-0 level phenomenology, which is not on happy age, so please listen to that. Well, soon I'll get to something that's on happy age, and then I can stop because you can read if you're interested. So it turns out that one loop integrating out Kaltzak-Klein particles, you can write a coupling between a BH, a Kaltzak-Klein mode of the hypercharged gauge boson, this is the field strength for it, and a photon field strength. This is actually the dual one. So this will be suppressed by the compactification scale, and there is some loop factor here that we have computed. Okay. Now this is a two-body. This would lead to a two-body decay of a B mu 1-0 to a BH 1-0 and a photon. So the question is, who's dominating this one loop-induced two-body decays or the three? Body decay, which is at three level, and which I showed you here. And after a long computation and many ups and downs and so on, we are now confident that this is the result. They are almost the same. Fine-tuning, I don't know why, but they turn out to be almost the same, which tells you that, let's see, B mu can go to, instead of here, if I cut that, this B mu can go into a photon and a BH. So not only we have lots of leptons, but we also have photons in these decays. So now you should tell me which great events in round one you have with photons and leptons and missing the T. And you can imagine that, for instance, on one side you can have four leptons, and on the other side you can have a photon, for instance. So these are really interesting events to see at the LHC. Four leptons plus one photon.
Well, you know, though, we've done a search in round two for those and just don't see any.
Yeah.
So,
which should be used to set the limit on this model, which I suspect is probably competing with this other one on trileptons. But if you see more events, let me know at some point. Okay. Now there is some story about the paper we wrote last year, which is basically the statement that the 1-1 modes can be produced in the S channel. These have Kaltzak-Klein parity plus 1, and therefore at one loop like that you can produce them. I think Eduardo gave a talk before we finished the paper here, so maybe you heard things like that. I probably should skip most of it. Now, let me just tell you something here, talking of coupling to mass. If you look at these spinless adjoints, they can couple to standard model particles via higher dimensional operators, so this is this one loop induced coupling, but you always have a derivative here. You want to construct a Lorentz invariant quantity. And now, if you integrate by parts, you put the derivative here, you find that this is actually proportional to the mass of the standard model particle. Which tells you that the spinless adjoints at the even levels, so 1, 1, coupled to quarks proportional to mass, and therefore the only dominant coupling is to the top quark, which tells you that you have these interesting diagrams where you produce a level one vector gluon in the S channel. This dot stands for one of those loops that violates Kaltzak Klein number, and then you have a usual cascade decay through the spinless adjoint, and this at some point has to decay, and it can decay only to TT bar. So that's a branching fraction of about 100%, which tells you that you have to look for TT bar resonances. Okay? And not only, but you can also have this decay to T and B bar from the charge W. So that's the other prediction, that we have not only TT bar resonance but also TB bar resonance. And here are our cross sections for the Tevatron I show you in this case, which are not quite yet constrained by the current limits on TT bar resonances, but within a year or so they will start being constrained. So,
well, the thing is, there's extra jets in those events, which would spoil the searches that we've done so far.
Yeah, I talked with some people from the top working group who were saying that maybe that's not such a bad thing to have them, but they have to be taken into account appropriately. You see,
go back one
yes.
slide to the TV, another slide. Yeah, TV.
Right.
That one.
This one.
Our search is sensitive to that.
Right. So I just had some communication with Darren Acosta, who says that this
Darren.
Right.
Yeah.
He says this is borderline constrained with the current data, but not quite. that's one issue, that the extra jets are not good for the sample that they are using.
Well, the interesting thing is that one of the jets, the bottom one, would be very energetic, right?
Well. Very energetic, meaning 50 GeV or something.
Why? Because the G is very heavy, right?
Let's see if I remember correctly. So let's see. This is
actually the Q11 is heavier than the Q11.
No. So he's talking G versus Q, and you see here the mass difference is about 100, maybe 100 and something. But this is for a large 1 over R. If you make 1 over R small enough to be relevant for the Tevatron, this is shrunk by a factor of 2 or so. So a 500, a 50 GeV jet or something like that.
Okay.
Which might be an opportunity, but again, the sample...
Well, that's
how
later have 200 GeV jets in them. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So cross section. What should I tell you? Maybe I should just finish this never-ending talk. Lots of interesting things to be studied here. Now that we have it in Calcab, probably anybody can check things and see how they like what's going on with the model. It's nicely motivated, although orthogonal to space symmetry. And at colliders, you have lots of things to look for. And thank you.
So I haven't quite understood whether there's anything special about Higgs sector in this model. What do you have to say about what the Higgs has? You have to start with the 0-0 Higgs mode, and then it has all its partners.
Right, exactly. So you have the 0 mode Higgs is the standard model Higgs doublet, which has a VEV, and you have a Higgs boson there. As in the standard model.
Yeah.
And then you are going to have the first Kaltzak Klein level is a complete Higgs doublet. So you have a charged particles and a neutral one, and then you have the whole tower.
But a single Higgs 0-0 mode is okay in the model. There's no anomaly constraint on that or anything like that.
It's extremely standard model like.
Do these all these other particles? Suppose you looked at something like Higgs to gamma decay mode. You'd start putting, I guess, all these other particles into the loops responsible for that. Do you have any idea what happens as a result?
There is a paper by I've seen a paper. I think there is a slight change. I think that's one of them, but then there is
that increases.
But also, wasn't
so it adds to the W loop, it comes in with the same sign as the W.
Maybe we can look at the paper. So that
blue,
has been
blue,
looked
blue
at.
Blue to Higgs, you know, which is color dominated.
That one certainly not enhanced.
You see,
that certainly what?
Enhanced.
Well, let's see. I mean, normally you put only fermions in, but he's got some bosons in here, so that could suppress that.
One. Right, but the computation has been done. I mean, that's good news that we can look it up on the archive. I haven't looked carefully at those. These are not tremendously huge effects because, you know, the fermions, for instance, are vector-like. They don't, their masses don't couple to
right,
the electric
yeah, so
scale.
They decouple, in other words, just
right.
A point unlike just a
exactly.
Repetition, fairly repetition.
Mm-hmm. Okay. No question?
Well, you make the program available publicly.
How much do you pay? Yes, we are going to make it public as soon as we finish the paper, because for now we are still finding things that are missing in it. Within 2 weeks, it's going to be public. 2 weeks in a theorist time. Are you going to use it? If you make it public? We strongly recommend it. It's really cool because it's so hard to do computation otherwise. There are too many particles. Ah, I should point out this S-channel thing. These are trivial. This is something that I was able to do without much pain. But when you look at pair production, this is pretty tough. And actually, there are many interesting issues that we are not studying in the paper that need to be studied. For instance, how many events do you have with plus charged leptons versus minus charged leptons. It turns out that, for instance, the LHC, you start with proton on proton, that leads to more events with the positive charged leptons than negative charged leptons. And you have things with that look like E plus, E minus, for instance, which I don't think appear in supersymmetry, or are they? I've never seen in supersymmetry anything like that. So
a single-sided chain decay?
Yeah, you combine. So the advantage is you have one extra step in the decay chain, and that's why you can get more stuff. So you get from a W plus on this side, you get one E plus, and you then get a pair like that, but then you also have a W plus on that side that gives you.
I mean, you can always get like-sided leptons from Bonino decay and then throw in another Z or something.
Yeah, but the extra Z would have an extra small cross branching fraction to give you leptons.
Well, sure, yeah. I mean, it's all a matter of rate. Yeah.
Right.
So it's not the same thing.
Yeah, factor theory.
Yeah, right.
Yes, it's going to be public for sure. It's too late. It should have been done years ago.
Mm-hmm.